This is Thrive Perspectives, an ever-growing discussion about the issues and ideas that shape our lives with your guide, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Hi there, this is Stuart from the Thrive Today Network. Welcome to Perspectives episode 48. It's great to have you with us and we've got a great episode. In fact, a series of episodes coming up where we intend to explore key aspects of our Christian worldview. Now, we may not be aware of it, but our worldview informs all our thoughts and actions in life, even if we don't consciously recognize that. So this is an important conversation for us to have. Matt and I are joined by our good friend and critical thinker, Connell, for what we hope will be an engaging conversation as we begin our series exploring the Christian perspective on life and the world. Well, Matt, it's great to be back in the studio again, recording an episode for our Perspective series. And we've got a guest with us today.
We have.
Yeah.
Welcome, Connell.
Welcome, Connell. Yeah. Oh,
thank you. Yeah.
Discussions always go better with three people, I think, Stu. So we just thought, Connell, that you were just the right sort of person. You got the right mix of intelligence and curiosity and you're just the sort of person to say, Matt, what are you on about here?
Exactly right. So, I'm way too polite, whereas I know Connell's not going to be. So that's great. We'll get some good questions going here. So, Matt, what are we going to be talking about?
We're going to talk about, we're going to explore some aspects of the Christian worldview. Big picture is really important, and particularly the frameworks, I guess, within which we think about life and the world, and the enormous difference that those frameworks make. Actually, it's one of the most important things that we need to think critically about. And I guess, if anything, this discussion hopefully will be a little bit of an exercise in critical thinking and big picture thinking, and a good example of how your framework actually makes a difference. Now, I'm going to explain, if you're listening and you're thinking, what on earth does that even mean? Yeah. We'll explain that in a moment.
And let me just say, buckle in, because if the pre-podcast conversation is anything to go by, this series will probably last another 3 or 4 years, but it's going to be great. And excellent, Matt. So, yep, go with us on this. And
So I came across a really useful diagram or a way of thinking about frameworks. Actually, I read fairly widely and actually read a lot of stuff from outside of of the Christian movement. You know, I love finding truth in that outside space. You know, particularly, you know, in that sort of when the various disciplines kind of confirm aspects of what we believe as Christians, because I expect that. I expect that, good research will come upon the truth. And I was reading a book by Jonathan Haidt called The Happiness Hypothesis. So it's a book in positive psychology, and he's a Jonathan Haidt, which is Haidt, is a very prominent social psychologist. Now, I should just say, when I cite different books and so, I'm not necessarily recommending endorsing the views in those books, that is, you know, what I was really just saying is I draw a lot from a lot of different sort of literature. I don't necessarily endorse their views and often, in fact, they're not, they're not Christians. Often they're even atheists. But yet I find I've illustrated, it's a little bit like, you know, going out to outer space and sitting on the moon and looking at the Earth. You really appreciate, oh, gee, it's really beautiful. You know, but we don't want to live out there. No. You know what I mean?
And also, we've got to be able to engage with our world. So knowing what other people are thinking and what they're believing, what's informing them is important.
That's important. And also because I teach as a lecturer in philosophy, so I need to be across some of these things. So this book by Jonathan Haidt, towards the end, he points out, he's done a lot of research into the emotion of disgust, which is really interesting to do research into that. But as part of his research into that, he found a connection between that emotion and another sort of dimension of experience that he talks about in terms of, and he finds this in a lot of other cultures, how that emotion is connected with a sense of defilement or impurity or and he found himself realizing that there's this whole other element of human experience. You know, and that research was really just the entry point into this discovery for him. That there's this whole other dimension that we in our culture don't really recognize. Mm. And the way that he illustrates this other dimension, and actually what I'm going to do is, and you'll have to, if you're listening to this, you're going to have to use your imagination a little bit now while I picture this.
Or a piece of paper and a pen even.
Yeah, or a picture. Yeah, that's right. That could be useful. And we'll pull this apart in a moment, but let me picture it. Mm. So this is a simplified version of a diagram that he uses. If we imagine, I guess in our culture, we tend to recognize only one dimension of human experience, and we can picture that as a line, a horizontal line, between pleasure and pain. You know, imagine pain on the left, you know, and a line, and then you've got pleasure on the right. You know,
at each extreme. So just to help the listeners, at the far end of the left hand side is pain. At the far end of the right hand side is
pleasure. Yeah, and you've got this line, and right, we're all trying to move along that line. You know, it's like, my life at the moment is pleasurable, and you could put other things at the end. It's a fairy pragmatic space. Mm. It's
could be power.
That's right. Mm. It's what a lot of psychologists talk about, just in terms of human well being.
Yep.
You know, it's the well being line. It's good and bad, useful, useless, pleasure, pain. It's that one element, and we tend to plot in our culture. Everything is plot on that line. So what's good is good for me, and our values tend to be plotted on that line. So if something's wrong, it's wrong because, well, it's going to hurt someone else, and if it doesn't hurt anyone, then it can't be bad, right? That's on that single line. What Jonathan Haidt though wants us to recognize is that there is this other dimension actually to human experience, and so we could illustrate this by placing a vertical line to create essentially a cross right through a vertical line right through that horizontal line, and at the bottom you've got, interestingly, a lot of elements of human experience that we work very hard just to
avoid
and get rid of, and in the wrong way. And I'll talk to that in a moment. But, experiences like shame, sense of defilement, this is where sort of the sense of guilt maybe sits, sense of impurity. And again, you can already sense how countercultural those very ideas even are. And so you've got, that's at the bottom end of that vertical axis, and it goes right up, and right at the top of that you've got an experience of the sublime, the sacred, the majestic, that these elevated elements of human experience, and so you've got this whole other dimension to human experience that we're kind of conditioned in a way to block that out, or certainly not taught to recognize anything on that vertical axis. And the reason, historically, and this probably goes back to about the time of Freud. This is how Sigmund Freud, the famous sort of father of psychology, in his infinite wisdom, dealt with this situation. Because we didn't like, he was faced with people, particularly late Victorian era, who were struggling with this experiences of shame and guilt and sense of defilement, and so the way that he dealt with that is, just we'll just get rid of the whole vertical axis, we'll just obliterate that whole, and that's not really grounded in anything valid.
Right.
It's just an illusion. You've just got to realize that. And when you realize that that's all just been put on you by society, because of course Sigmund Freud was a hardcore atheist, doesn't really give, he never gives, any compelling reasons for that. That's just his presupposition. So he just says, well, society has put that guilt on, and that shame. And this is very topical because people still think that, that shame, if people feel any sense of moral shame, well, society has put that on us. And so as a society, we need to agree not to do that anymore. And yes, in you know, the way that in the, you know, Victorian and Edwardian eras, you know, sort of, you know, 19th century, early 20th century, there was lots of shame. It was a culture of shame and, you know, a lot of social pressure to, you know, and if you, you know, if you cross the line, you'd be ostracized. Yes, absolutely. All of that's completely terrible.
So a bit like, Matt, just to help us understand here, so a bit like you can't have cold if there isn't hot.
Yeah.
So if we eliminate hot, there isn't cold.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah, that's right.
So what he was really saying was the concept of sacred and glorious and wonder and all those sorts of things. If we eliminate that, then we also eliminate the opposite of that, which is the shame and the disgust. And
So it's
and
desensitized. I mean, Brené Brown did a thing recently, a very famous TED talk, you know, where she talks about desensitizing ourselves to experiences of sadness.
Yeah.
Well, she's actually talking more about sadness and pain. You know, we try to, you know, we use all sorts of different ways to actually essentially anesthetize ourselves, you know. But she says if you desensitize yourselves to pain, you actually desensitize ourselves to joy as well. And so you end up just desensitized, you know. And so essentially what has happened from that time on is that those particular at the bottom end of the vertical axis, they're very spiritual. That's a very spiritual, those are very spiritual things, you know, experiences of guilt and shame and impurity. And it requires a sort of transcendent dimension to give any validity to that. Because if we're just biological machines and, you know, then well, no, we decide. And you know, our culture is very single axis society. You know, I decide what's right for me, and we're all into, there's no transcendent sort of ideal or anything. And so we just need to agree amongst ourselves and tolerate each other. And so we've lost that. The vertical, it doesn't quite make sense. The vertical line, really. But what we've also done by desensitizing ourselves to those experiences of shame and guilt and whatever, we've also lost a sensitivity to the sublime and the glorious. And not you know, there's still a longing for it, and we go after that in lots of different interesting, and this itself is very Freudian, like in sort of disguised ways. We seek, whether it's through sport or through a, you know, looking for glory in all the wrong places, you know, because we're built for an experience of elevation. Yeah, well, what Jonathan Haidt says is that we are actually wired for an experience that he refers to as something like divinity. You know, there is, human beings are, and it's interesting because he says whether or not God exists. Now, he's an atheist. He's a Jewish atheist. And this is where I think his thinking is inconsistent, because he talks about we're wired as human beings for this experience of divinity, essentially. A longing for the sacred and the sublime, and you know, and he says then whether or not God exists. Well, that's where I think he's inconsistent. But this is where I take his. This is incredibly, you know, incredibly important point that he makes, because we are wired for this, and we're wired to need this.
So, is this actually the language that Jonathan Haidt uses? Because it seems like inconceivable that an atheist would use those sorts of words, because it's like, yeah, I don't even know how you'd start to reconcile that. But it does actually, if that's the way he's talking about it and projecting it, it actually adds a whole lot more weight.
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
actually being a valid framework or a valid model to actually look at how to see our world in those multiple axes. What is the words that Jonathan Haidt, is it? Does he use words like divine?
Yeah,
or
he does.
Even sacred, I would have thought.
Yeah, he does. He talks about that we're wired for, and he says at one point what I would perhaps call divinity, and that's when he quickly says, "Oh, whether or not God exists," and it's like, what? What do you mean? You know, and he, And actually, it's interesting because he offered, this is the, I've been studying the Bible for, you know, decades, and he offered one of the best explanations for all of the purity laws in the Old Testament that I've ever read. Like, you know, he says, this is why, because his research led him to go to, you know, other culture outside the Western culture. Because actually, that one dimension, you know, single axis way of living is actually really just kind of European culture, post-Enlightenment European thing. But every other culture acknowledges this other dimension. And he refers to, you know, not only the Old Testament Jewish purity laws, but, you know, other cultures that have these purity laws. And he said, you, in order to understand this, you have to understand this other dimension to human experience. Because you know, it's what they're doing is they're recognizing this vertical. I mean, he's using a slightly more complex framework, but it's like they're sensitizing themselves, deliberately sensitizing themselves. By sensitizing themselves to what is impure, they're sensitizing themselves to what is sublime and sacred as well. That's and so, you know, for example, the Old Testament purity laws, you know, explicitly, in fact, you know, God says through Moses, I want my people to distinguish between the holy and the unholy, the pure and the impure. They need to learn this. So I'm going to embed it in every aspect of their lives. I'm going to embed it. And so he offers this explanation. I'm thinking, oh, that's really good. Thanks, Mister. You know,
you can almost see the struggle.
Yeah, but he's got this Jewish background as well, which probably probably helps.
But he's backing himself into a corner, and then
he's
struggling to get himself back out of it. He doesn't want to go to where.
Yeah, I think so. Particularly because his brand of atheism now actually is becoming more and more rare. Really, that, you know, I mean, it's more likely now for people to be agnostics, but that there is. And I should say, you know, that single axis is based on there being no other dimension to human life. You know, it's just me. It's just us. You know, we make our own meaning. There's no transcendent meaning to life on this horizontal, you know, if you accept that. You know, there's no ideal for what humanity is, no purpose for humanity. So I decide who I am and what I'm going to do. And an ethics on a single axis says, I should never deny what, you know, human autonomy then becomes, in the this sacred. Sense, sacred, really, exactly. Doesn't it? Sacred, it becomes the new human autonomy. So, you know, so you get to decide who you are and what, you know, and your purpose. And I should never, ever contradict that. That's your sacred right, almost. That's enough. But, you know, but once you add this other dimension, then, no, of course we don't have it. That's, of course we don't have the right to do that.
Yeah, that's right. Because I know one of the first things when I first heard you talking about this, it seemed like it was actually a really good framework or model to explain a whole lot of things about how we think.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks, whether you like it or not, whether you believe there is that second vertical dimension, it's going to have an impact on you, whether you like it or not. You're going to be trying to get away from the obvious fact that there's a sacredness in life, and there is a profane aspect of it, because, you know, that's often the struggle that atheists have is explaining all of those. How do those even make sense in a purely naturalistic worldview? But I think also when you think about those two dimensions, you can't escape that second vertical projecting itself onto that single axis. So as much as you try to live on that single axis, you're going to have to confront those ideas. I think they're
irrepressible. They're bursting out of us.
They're irrepressible. Yeah. But I think by the time, if you only stand on the single axis and try to view them from the single axis, they become like corrupted versions of what actually is. So, you know,
It's a great call.
Inevitably, like when you showed that vertical axis and you showed that there was the sacred at the top and the profane at the bottom, I thought I knew what the word sacred actually meant. And when you put it on that axis and showed it as another dimension, I'm looking at it and go, but what then, what is sacred then?
Yeah.
If, because I haven't really thought about that vertical axis in the way that you framed it. Yeah. I would look at it as a single axis. I almost call most people probably were single axis dwellers.
Yeah.
In the sense that we live on the single axis. Yeah. And so when we look at the sacred, we kind of see it as, well, what is sacred? Maybe it's a church. It's something that we've built.
Yeah.
My and footy team.
We've set aside, even if, I actually had a look on, I had a look in the dictionary to say, well, what does the dictionary say?
Something, about the sacred.
What is sacred? Yeah. And it basically says it's something that's set apart with a spiritual, it's for worship or revering something of us. And so you kind of look at that and go, but that's not the sacred that's on the top of that second axis, because that's almost like that's something that we set apart.
Yeah.
We're on the second, on that vertical, the sacred that's there is actually God set it apart.
Yeah.
We had no say in it, what was sacred or not.
Yeah.
And so because God set it apart, from the single axis, it might actually look ridiculous.
Yeah.
It might look pedantic.
Yeah.
It means that we're always trying to go, it's almost like on that single axis, you know, God gave us autonomy in the world.
Yeah.
We kind of get to call the shots a fair bit, don't we, by living here in the world.
Yeah.
And it's almost like on that single axis, God lets us call the shots. We get to make those decisions. We get to pursue pleasure and so on. And we bear out the consequences of the decisions that we make. In that vertical axis, we have no say whatsoever, because it's like that's God declares what's sacred and as a result, what's profane. And when we enter that axis, it's almost like we're kind of giving up almost our autonomy and going, I have to, God's declared it as not so much giving up our autonomy, but our ability to call the shots. So we don't get to say that's reasonable or unreasonable or that's fair or unfair. So like in Leviticus, you know, weaving two threads into your garment, you would look at that and go, that is ridiculous. But you don't get to make that call because God declared that as sacred.
Yeah.
And another example is the Ark of the Covenant, you know, with the, was it Uz? Uzzah.
Yeah, you use Uzzah. Yeah, Uzzah. Yeah, yeah.
So, he
touched the ark and he died. Yeah, yeah.
And the ark fell off.
Yeah. Incomprehensible to people. It's like, what? That's terrible. That God's nasty. Mean. Yeah. Yeah.
You reached out and grabbed it.
Yeah. Because it was absolutely sacred. Yeah.
And you weren't allowed to touch it. And as a result of that, he died. I look at that and go, that's ridiculous.
Yeah. Mm. Because the sacred comes with boundaries. Mm. You know, if something is sacred, then it can only be used in a certain way for sacred purposes. And
Can I just suggest, though, and I totally get what you're saying and totally agree with you, but I think what we do to eliminate the God accountability is we decide to make our own sacred.
Yeah.
And we decide what's sacred and we decide what's profane. And that's why we have all these different levels of, you know, within.
Yeah. And that's the definition you see in the dictionary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that the sacred
it's
is
the
something
human-centered
we
definition.
Decide. Mm. Yeah. We build a church or we have icons and we declare them to be sacred.
Yeah.
And then, and I think even as Christians then, we come to that and we create our sacred spaces. It's almost like a kind of a way of us staying on the single axis, even as a Christian, and not venturing into vertical axis, so that we actually go to these places and treat that as sacred.
And appease our kind of need for it.
And I'm not sort of downplaying the importance of that, because I think those things can be important, but I think only in the sense that they kind of point us to where, or lead us to a place where we're ready to step into the real sacred, which is stepping into the sacred that God's declared as sacred, and equally what God has declared to be profane by virtue of it, you know, defiling what is sacred. Mm. And again, it's not necessarily what we, as sort of single access dwellers, generally think is right or fair or reasonable, because we've only got such a small, corrupted, tiny. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting to note how words change their meaning. Mm. Actually, even words change their meaning depending on your framework. So take the word love. This is a classic example. On a single axis, and I should say if axis is not, you know, is like AXIS, yes. You know, we're talking about the an lines. Axi. When we're talking about, yep. You know, an axis.
So imagine a graph. Again, yeah. This is going to be important, listeners, just to jot down, because we're going to probably over the next, I don't know, 300 episodes, we're going to refer to this axis. And so
it's not all going to be about this, and we'll use different ways of illustrating this.
But it's good to understand there's a vertical and a horizontal, and they cross, and that's what we're talking about when we talk about the axis.
Yeah, and the horizontal axis is valid in that, yes, pleasure and pain are real aspects of life. And we'll talk, you know, we will get to talking about, I guess, some of those experiences because, you know, pain can actually be a sanctifying thing, as can pleasure, actually, both of those, but only if you add that. That vertical axis.
So you were talking about the meaning of the
meaning
word
of words. So on a single horizontal axis, the word love, and this is borne out by one of the more common philosophical definitions of the word love. To love something is to attribute value to a thing. Now, there's a problem with that definition because I'm the one that attributes the value. It's exactly what you were saying, Connell, about, you know, we say what's sacred. On the single axis, we take the prerogative to decide what's sacred is what's sacred to me. Well, the word love is really defined by what I personally value. So to love something is to, I attribute the value to that thing. Now, that this is a completely insufficient, you know, definition of love, I think should be very obvious to anyone who's ever, for example, loved their child. Mm. Well, they're only sacred because they're sacred to me. No, there's something inherently sacred. So that's on a single axis. Love is I attribute value to. But on a double axis, where you've got this transcendent dimension, where there are some things that are inherently sacred because of the value that God that they have inherently as being created by God for a certain purpose. So to love then on a double axis means essentially the recognition of infinite sacred value. This means that love is not just reduced to desire on a single axis. I attribute value for this, you know, because I desire that thing. And, you know, I mean, there's quite awful sort of definitions and reductionist views of you know, of love and, you know, even love for our children. Oh, it's because of, you know, natural selection.
Evolution.
And, you know, and we're wanting to preserve our genetic, you know, our gene pool.
That's not even real. I've had conversations with atheists before where they talk about, one of the kind of things to make them feel uncomfortable about their worldview is that example of love, and you go home to your children at night and you love your children, you know, more than anything else in the world.
Yeah.
And yet that love is nothing. It's actually nothing. It's just purely evolution. It's just, it's just a chemical in your brain that makes it necessary for you to do that in order to preserve and, you know, create the next generation. Yeah. That's what you're reducing.
It's just like instinct, some kind of evolutionary instinct.
Yeah.
It's quite awful. And actually, I think intuitively, we know that it's more deep down. So it's not just instinct or desire. And there's no doubt that there's that element, because we're not denying the horizontal axis here. No. So there is. I desire my children and I desire to be with them, and so there's that desire element. But it's more than that. My love actually is a kind of knowledge of something transcendent.
Yeah.
It's the recognition of a transcendent element in the other person. So, which is why, of course, you know, love your neighbor as yourself has this sense of recognize the sacredness of your humanity, the inherent dignity of being created by God as a child of God with a specific purpose, right? Now, if something's sacred, again, It can't be used in any other way. Suddenly there is responsibilities that come with that, and that's the bit we don't like. Mm. Sacredness doesn't go with an anything goes approach to anything. But it's a kind of way of knowing. Mm-hmm. It's like I recognize this sacred element. Now you need the double axis to even go there, because it requires that other transcendent dimension.
Well, it does, because it's like when you present it, I actually see some of the conversations I've had with atheists, they actually start getting a little angry at even, because it's at that example I would use about going home to your children. And now that if you want to ignore that kind of transcendent reality, that love is not just something that drives you forward to reproduce, and it's just a chemical in your brain that your children are actually not worth anything. Yeah. They are nothing.
Yeah.
They only mean something when there is that more transcendent reality there, which they want to deny.
Yeah.
They have to come face to face with that, and they can't, because built into them is a sense that life is sacred, their children are sacred, that their love for their children is actually real. Like, it is actually a real thing. It's not just a biological process in your body. Yeah. You actually love them.
Yeah.
You actually really do, irrespective of what your brain...
And yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And they're worth loving as well. And they cannot escape that reality.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And so the concept of the sacred is very much connected with this sense of this particular meaning. There is a particular meaning and purpose. And of course, if you get rid of any transcendent element, you lose that any aspect of meaning. So even the word meaning has a different meaning. We don't want to get too esoteric here, but on a double axis. Now it's interesting because this word gets thrown around. You don't want to live a meaningful life, and people talk about that on that flat, horizontal axis. And well, we provide our own meaning, and it's interesting. There's a South African philosopher, David Benatar, who has argued, he's an atheist, but he's argued there cannot be any meaning to life, any transcendent meaning without a God who, because meaning requires some kind of designer or some this sense of transcendent purpose. But without that, to talk of meaning to life is actually meaningless.
Well, a lot of atheists say there is no meaning to life.
Yeah, that's right, and that's what. Well, that's exactly what he's saying. He's saying there's no meaning. Now it's interesting that the atheist Michael Ruse, and his book is called something A Meaning to Life, I think, addresses this issue where he says no, we can, we can have meaning, but what he finds meaning in the evolutionary process, that we're evolving and we're becoming better, and so we need to be the best that we can be, and that's where our meaning.
But there's no real transcendent meaning beyond that. Meaning is only going so far. It's creating a meaningful existence for us in the here or now. But ultimately, there is no meaning.
No, that's right. Yeah, there's not. So, I think David Benatar's point is, it's not a popular viewpoint, but it's a consistent one, because he's saying don't be talking about meaning to life, and I mean he has a very pessimistic view of life is quite the nihilist, really. But he is consistent. He's very consistent because he says meaning actually comes from a transcendent. You have to believe that there's something transcendent. Mm-hmm. And he says there isn't. So can we all get over it? There's no meaning to life, right? Let's stop looking for it.
Yeah.
It's an unfortunate view. And but that's again, that's something. It's these spillovers from this intuition that we have that there is this other dimension, and as Jonathan Haidt argues, we are actually wired for this. He cites research that actually shows that human well-being is at least to some extent dependent on us on what he refers to as experiences of elevation, a need, you know, a need to be elevated. Now, you know, he talks about peak experiences and, you know, experiences of beauty and the sublime and all of these things. And that's, I think, where it all gets a bit wishy-washy in his work, because ultimately, you know, it's really being unlocked from those bottom end experiences of shame and guilt and impurity. You know, they are real, and it's like, in a sense, he's wanting to say they're, because he does want to say they're real, because he wants to say we do experience these things.
But what does he think they are? Are they just still ultimately chemical processes in our brain, or
I think he wants to go a little further than Freud. Than he wants to say more than they're not just socially put upon us, so in you know, by virtue of our social situation.
So does it come,
because
from
he wants to say no, they are, we are actually wired.
Yeah,
that we're wired for something here. And he connects it. He does connect it with sort of evolutionary kind of, you know, a sort of distaste for things that are dead and you know, and things to do with health. And and he sort of connects it with that, but he also wants to say that it's connected with that, but he wants to validate a holistic view as well, that it's not just a physical, it's not just that, that we are wired for something else. So,
perhaps one of the things around the meaning, what you were saying before, Connell, about, you know, what is the real meaning? I think for a lot of people who aren't, you know, who don't have a fairly strong vertical axis or any kind of vertical axis, this concept of the progress of society, you know, we're doing better. And so the whole meaning of everything is that I contribute my bit to make society better by the time I leave and the next lot along, and we're just constantly trying to make...
So life becomes more pleasurable and less painful.
Exactly,
and,
right.
And yeah, and that's us moving along...
The horizontal axis.
And individually, most people live their lives to avoid pain and acquire pleasure, you know. But those lives, as we know, people that have access to all the pleasures in the world can end up the emptiest people of all. Yeah. I mean, this is, you know, and this is what Jonathan Haidt recognizes, that actually this does not actually satisfy the deepest elements, our deepest needs, because we actually require meaning. And this, of course, is the insight, was the great insight of and Stu, you were saying you've been, you know, reading Viktor Frankl's work. Mm-hmm. And Viktor Frankl, you know, very famous psychiatrist, psychologist, and he...
Holocaust survivor.
A Holocaust survivor as well. And his contribution really is to show how deeply human beings, even for their very survival, actually need meaning. Mm. Again, we're wired for a need for meaning. So his, the very famous book of his, that is, it's a short book, and it's one of the best reads. I do recommend this book, called Man's Search for Meaning. He's a Jew and I believe some kind of believing Jew. Mm. He picked up from his observations in the camps that it actually, all things being equal, and the, you know, because there was obviously the element of just people being randomly killed in that terrible, you know, context, and it describes the terrible just senselessness of what they went through, and that actually drove people to despair. And actually, suicide was quite a common common thing in those times, and a lot of people just gave up. You know, he saw that constantly. He said actually the people that tended to survive were the people, those that found some sense of meaning in the midst of that circumstance. So he talks about people, you know, there were people that, because they you know, living on, you know, kind of crust, such meager rations. And he talks about, you know, there'd be people that just going crazy from hunger, and he talks about these people that would walk up to them, put their last little, their whole ration, and put it before them on the table. Here, mate, you have this, you know. And he observes that it was actually the givers, not the receivers. All things being equal, it was the givers, not the receivers, who tended to be the survivors. Mm. Because they found they found this sense of meaning. And actually, Viktor Frankl himself made the decision. He had the opportunity to move to a camp that was going to be much more comfortable. I mean, you know, everything's relative, but it was going to be better than Auschwitz. He was in Auschwitz. And he chose to stay because he was working as a doctor in looking after the inmates. He chose to stay there to do that. And he says that sense of purpose that he found, that sense of meaning, was really the key to his survival. We are intuitively, innately built with a sense that there is a meaning. There is this other dimension.
Yeah.
And meaning is actually got a lot, you know, our purpose in life has got a lot to do with that elevation trajectory, to bring out the glory, the sublime, in everything, you know, it's to cultivate the sacred. Genesis, you know, 1 and 2 depict human beings as being like the gardeners in a sacred garden. And in fact, it's almost like temple language that's being used there. That they are like the priests in this mm-hmm. beautiful garden. And their role is to bring out and cultivate what is beautiful and sacred and sublime, because we were created to reflect the image and the glory of God. That's a sacred, sacred purpose right there.
Yeah. So really, it's almost like our orientation is a bit distorted, because I think by default we live on that horizontal axis, you know, certainly within our culture anyway. Yeah. We're brought up in that. And so when we view everything from that single axis, we do look at it as either the pursuit of pleasure and avoiding pain as the motivator. But what I guess we're not saying is that everything on that single axis is purposeless or invalid or not worth pursuing. But if you are actually able to get up higher on the vertical axis and view it from that perspective, so if you could view the world and life and things that are created around us without the advantage of that vertical axis and getting up higher and experiencing it from that sense of, you know, getting out of that and looking down at it, then it's like we can actually start to enjoy the things that we're meant to enjoy here in this life that aren't necessarily, I guess, they're sacred anyway, because God put them here. They're there for us to enjoy. But without the benefit of standing from that position, we actually bring them down to just something that gives me pleasure. So I see things in this world that give me pleasure, and I pursue them, and that's it. Those things in themselves aren't necessarily wrong, but they're unfulfilling because I'm not viewing it from
that's right.
higher.
Because there's this other dimension. So, you know, in a sense, on the double axis, all the pleasures of life, and God did create a beautiful world for us to enjoy, but they have this what I would perhaps call a sacramental quality to it. And by that I mean they're gifts in a relational interchange. But when you take the relational interchange, it's like, you know, came in here you came and you brought me a coffee, and that was a very kind thing to do, right? And it's kind partly because it's thoughtful, and so it becomes, so your gift isn't just about the fact that I actually really did feel like a coffee this morning, and but the fact that you were thoughtful and you brought that, actually there's another significance to that. It's a relational, the thing itself takes a new significance because it's something that takes on meaning within a relational interchange. So the pleasures of life, you know, are still, you know, still valid, but they take on this whole extra significance. But this is Frankl's point, is that so can pain.
I was just going to say, So even from the same elevation, you can look on pain. And one of his quotes, and I haven't got it exactly right, is a strong enough why will counter anyhow. In other words, if your meaning, if your purpose, you can deal with any pain because you know the vertical, the purpose of it all. And just coming back to your point before around the traveling along the pleasure kind of, I think if you take out the sense of sacred at the top, then it becomes entitlement rather than sacramental. In other words, it's like I'm entitled to this rather than it being a gift.
Yeah.
You know, I'm entitled to have this coffee because that's what life's all about. You bringing me the coffee as opposed to recognizing the gift, that the sacramental value of it. Anyway.
Yeah, so. That's right. There's I mean, we'll talk in the next episode. We'll talk about a lot of elements of experience. You know, we'll plot elements of experience because there is actually a really strong connection between what is pleasurable in the most sublime sense for us. The pleasure and the sacred is a connection with that, and but pleasure can also go wrong. You know, and so we'll talk about some elements of human experience actually on this double axis. Just another interesting. I keep footnoting, and it's just academic habit. There's a quite a well-known book by American philosopher Michea Eliade called The Sacred and the Profane, and he surveys a lot of mainly what we in our culture unfortunately refer to as primitive religious behavior, you know, amongst people. And you know, I think it's in some ways it shows, if anything, this innate religiosity of human beings, that we have this innately. And he, you know, he really explores this, and he shows these amazing common elements in this base level kind of intuitive spirituality in all of these different cultures. And he laments the fact that we have moved beyond this basic intuition and we've called it progress. And he describes it as a kind of a fall, actually, that we've lost this whole dimension of the sacred and the profane. Again, because we didn't like the experience of, you know, of the profane, so we just got rid of the whole thing. Yet again, another scholarly voice saying to our culture, hang on, everyone, we've actually lost something here, and let's not call it, can we not call this progress, right? Because this is, oh yeah, we've moved beyond all of that primitive stuff. We do this really patronizing, and it's interesting in our climate. I mean, we're all about the sort of post-colonial, you know, let's not you know, invalidate all different cultures but, you know, well, okay, yes, let's not do that. Because actually every other culture that's ever existed has had this strong sensitivity to the sacred and the profane. And yet, in our culture today, you know, we virtually, you know, punish people for showing any sensitivity or concern about, you know, about that vertical trajectory, and the fact that no, actually, there is this other element. There is a purpose. If something is sacred, it isn't anything goes, doesn't work on that. And and yet that's kind of offensive in our, it's become offensive because no, we hold sacred on that single axis, autonomy. I decide what's right. That's single axis thinking.
Yeah.
You don't have that, you know, that luxury. And no one in any of these other cultures felt that they had the prerogative.
Yeah.
You know, as you were saying before, Colin, that no one felt that they had the prerogative to decide what's sacred. It's a contradiction.
Well, we're so used to us determining what's right and reasonable and fair and just. And I think the true sacredness is what's decided by God. And it will be something, it will rub against us because we're so used to operating from that vantage point, that sense of entitlement, I suppose, even that we've got from living on the single axis, where we get to challenge those things and even decide what's sacred and what's profane and all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And we don't like it when God says, I'm declaring this sacred.
Yeah.
And he doesn't need our permission. He doesn't need our buy-in. It's a declaration that he makes it sacred. It's sacred because God says it's sacred.
Absolutely.
That's it. End of story.
Yeah.
You know, and so whether it makes sense to you is irrelevant.
Yeah.
It makes sense to God.
Yeah. It's connected. It's connected with God's character and God's purpose.
Yeah.
You know, and if something has a particular purpose, you know, it's set apart for that purpose. I think there are a lot of things to explore here, and again, if I can just anticipate where I think some of the amazing things that we can where we'll go with this, you know, I mean, you know, we'll talk a bit about, like, there are a number of elements of human experience that are profoundly validated, actually. Mm-hmm. when you add this axis, and that really can't be made sense of. And so we'll talk about some of those experiences. This is where any talk about sexuality and some of the biblical boundaries about sexuality, it's not just about spoiling all the fun and being puritanical and that only makes sense on this double axis. So there's something to talk about there. And how this framework actually changes the way that we think. And it's worth spending some time on this topic, because I really do think that even a lot of Christians today live their lives on that horizontal, on that horizontal axis. And God's job is to help me get along, get away from pleasure, away from pain and towards pleasure. That's sort of God's role, is to help me along that horizontal line. No, actually, God's prerogative is to elevate you up the... not just help you along the horizontal line, but elevate you up that vertical. And yes, God, but the profound thing is that God can profoundly sanctify experiences of pleasure and pain. And this is, we'll talk a little bit about this, but this is life changing. This is potentially life changing stuff. And I know it might sound academic, but I think if we can embrace this and think about ways, how can I become more sensitive? And invariably the way, if I can suggest this, is to allow yourself to experience what's at the bottom end of that. Because it was to set us free from the bottom end of that vertical axis, the experience of guilt and shame and sense of defilement. That is why God cares. He doesn't want us to stay there. But the solution isn't to get rid of just repress the whole experience. It is actually to find that forgiveness and freedom that we have through Jesus Christ. And this is where I think the Christian message is just so, so powerful, because God, through Christ, unlocks us from that and elevates us, makes us holy, and lifts us up to a higher place. And that's what, that's what our journey is all about. We're going to explore that more.
Connell, Matt, great conversation. We'll look forward to picking this up next time. Thanks for joining us for Perspectives.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Thrive Perspectives. Our hope is that these discussions will challenge you to look at life from a new perspective. You'll find all our resources at the Thrive Today website, thrivetoday.tv. If there's a topic that you'd like us to discuss, please email us. Our email is contact@thrivetoday.tv. Until next time, our prayer is that you will thrive.